Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
And this is the Donalana Kitchen. We get by with a little help from our friends.
Oh, yes. The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. For more information, go to the Mucky Duck Pub.com or call the pub and ask for Marcus.
Well, welcome to our kitchen table today. We gather here to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. Yes, we do. We get around to all that stuff eventually. And this is community radio. It's kind of like a local treasure because it's made up of all these local people doing local things. Go to khoifm.org. There's a great website there that can tell you all about this station and find out all of the local programming that is produced here by your friends and neighbors. And there's national programming too. Lots of good things going on. Well, I went to an interesting thing last weekend. On Sunday, the Ames Public Library Friends had a gathering called an author cafe, and they had Art Cullen from
Art Cullen from our Pulitzer Prize winning local hero.
He writes a paper up in Storm Lake, and also joining him was Michael Crum from here at Ames, and they talked about the newspaper business and that.
Ooh, it's a rough time in the newspaper business.
It was very good, and actually Art Cullen also talked about, well, Iowa in general. And the things, the roads we are going down, and environmental issues.
And how our roads are going down.
Oh, lots of things. And water, important things. He has written a book, coming back from his Pulitzer Prize winning prize. He was convinced to write a book. And he originally said, I can't write a book. And because he said, he said, I can't write anything longer than 700 words. He said, I don't ever write a book. But he did. Of course, he put together this great book called Storm Lake, and it's about Iowa, of course. It's a fine read. So Art Cullen and the book Storm Lake. What was nice about this gathering? Art Cullen is probably kind of, there's not many of them left. He is an independent breed. His family owns the newspaper that he produces. He is beholden to no one. So he is very...
Except his readers.
But he is very outspoken. He treats his readers like they have a brain, and he can say, as he said, he can say pretty much whatever he wants, and that's his job.
The Pulitzer Prize that he won, wasn't that for his coverage of water quality in Iowa?
Right.
I think so, yeah.
Right. The pollution.
A big deal, and it's,
the Des Moines
it's
River.
A good thing for all of us that he spoke out without vested interests in the economics of the situation.
Yeah. And he can still be very to the point as to what he says. And it was interesting to compare him to, and compare and contrast, Michael Crum is the local Ames paper, and he does a good job talking about local issues, too. But just because of what the Ames paper is, they are part of a larger consortium.
Right. You're not, it's not locally owned.
So just, well, of course, personalities were there, too. So it's interesting to see the power of the press and
today. To say we're lucky that we even have a local paper in Ames.
How important that is. They talked about that very much. Oh, another thing about the gathering. It was called an author cafe. I walk in, and actually it was a fundraiser event, too, so for the library. But I walk in, and the whole lecture hall is laid out as a tea room. There were tablecloths. There were teapots. There were sandwiches and cookies. I didn't realize that I would get to hear Art Cullen with cookies, too. But good job. Thank you to the Ames Public Library for bringing that fine lecture to Ames. I enjoyed it a lot. And I'm enjoying reading the book, Storm
Lake. Yes, we have a good library in town, a very good library, and our own newspaper. We're still lucky.
We
are. Lucky little community.
Aunt Donna, you went to a lecture.
Oh, last night, and the Memorial Union was the annual Shivers Lecture. funded through the Leopold Center by the Shivers family. This is an ongoing annual event where they bring in a notable speaker. This year it was Angie Tagtow, who is a dietitian who works a lot in public policy. She lives, 20 minutes south of town here. And she recently, during the last administration, actually went to work in Washington, D.C. She was invited by the Vilsack USDA to come in and work on the national dietary guidelines, which have to be reissued every 5 years. So her discussion last night was about the process of how those dietary guidelines are crafted. You know, first they start with the science, and then they get input, and then comes the public pressure, which is mostly, as Angie said, what really happens is the lobbyists take a look at what they're proposing, and they run right to their congressman that they have been making large donations to, and then the Congress people start to put a lot of pressure on the USDA. No, you can't do this. No. And during Angie's tenure at the USDA, the question was, and I had followed this on national media also, because I'm a little bit of a policy wonk here. There was the question of introducing sustainability issues into the picture of what we should be eating. Because, for example, there was a recommendation a number of years ago that, you know, Americans consume X number of portions of fish. Okay, well, when they did the math, they realized that if all Americans followed those guidelines, we'd eat all the fish in the ocean. So that was not, quote, sustainable. That was not even practical. It was impossible. And it was a huge oversight because one siloed part of the science community was looking at optimally, you know, probably essential fatty acids that come from fish, whereas the other part of the community has been, and the very big concern, you know, is depleting the ocean's resources. We're well down that path. So she was just talking about, you know, the give and take necessary in those federal processes. Some of them are quite important, and other ones are simply vested interests. And, you know, for example, because Angie was very politic about this, but in the dietary guidelines, the science has been showing over the last 10 years more and more concretely that it's important to eat more plant-based foods and perhaps to reduce. We're not talking about everybody should be a vegan or everybody should be a vegetarian, but we do need to consume perhaps less animal proteins. And when that was, you know, the language around that and the impetus behind that, putting that into the dietary guidelines in this country, huge pushback from all the, you know, high protein meat industry lobbyists, and they are very powerful. And then Angie, in her discussion last night, also brought up, for example, in Canada, when the dietary guidelines are being issued, the Canadian version of the USDA and that implements those guidelines completely insulates the people writing the guidelines from that kind of industrial pushback, so that the Canadian guidelines, for example, can really write what the latest best health and nutrition findings are for the population at large, irregardless of the financial effects of that on certain industries. So the discussion last night was really about Angie's going forth from her work in Iowa, and her work in Iowa has been considerable in terms of, like, she worked on the WIC program and nutrition and a lot of those kinds of things. And then she went to the USDA for a number of years. And fortunately for us, she has come back to Iowa. So Angie's very articulate, and it was a wonderful lecture. And thank you to the Shivers family for funding that sort of dialogue. And I must say, a good thing that I saw in the audience, because it was well attended, there were a number of kids who are students at ISU studying dietary habits and nutrition. You know, we have a rather large department there based on that. And so I think Angie's experiences were very relevant to the younger generation who's going to be carrying this work forward. So overall, it was a really lovely evening.
Very good. So we eat. We consume. And at the other end of that, and we don't like to think about this often, but it's becoming more and more of an issue. There's trash. There's things we get rid of. There's wrappers. There's things we throw away. There's all the extra food we throw away. There's trash. It's globally and locally, it's been in the headlines lately. And Donna keeps sending me things, and I run across headlines, too. Here's some of the headlines that we're going to discuss today. The world's recycling is in chaos. China shuts down its doors to taking our recyclables. More and more, America's recyclable plastic is being burned, not recycled, because of the stopgap solution after the Chinese ban on foreign waste. And the idea of microplastics, all this plastic stuff, ends up in our environment. And here's one that I like. And humans are pooping plastic, and no one is certain how bad that is. Now, that has something to do with the stuff we throw away. So trash. Joining us at the kitchen table today is Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, and she's got things to say about that.
Yeah, Bronwyn is... She has two functions in our community. She is the operation manager at Wheatsville Co-op, and she's also on the city council as a member at large. So, Bronwyn has taken a personal interest in some of these issues, thank goodness.
And welcome to our table.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, glad to be here.
So, I think in the news stories, the headlines that Lana was, what has jumped out to me is that last year in 2018, basically China decided they are not going to buy any more of our, recyclable plastic waste. So it looks like the world at large was sending huge percentage of that waste. Now, European countries and, most of the Western world was sending all of that because shipping was not too expensive, and China was actually paying for it, and they were processing it and recycling it and making more plastic widgets and sending it back to us. However, China has decided that for their own reasons, the overt reason seems to be that there's too much contamination. The plastics are not clean enough. So they have blocked that, and that shut down something like 80, 90, high 90s percentage of we don't have anywhere to put it now. All of a sudden, boom, that whole system got shut down, and we're stuck. What do we do with it? And that reverberates all the way down to Ames. What are we going to do with this? The system where we were shipping it to, there are other third world countries that are taking it, but the point is this system is not working and will not continue to work. So what are we going to do?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, the recycling market, I think, had been challenging for years, even before China's decision to
It was bound to break down eventually.
Yeah.
But it happened very quickly because China made a unilateral government decision, as they can do.
Exactly. And I think now in the States, we're just starting to see the effect of that. So people had kept recycling at the same rate, and it's all getting backed up. And so now you're seeing cities tackling this issue of what to do with recycling that they used to have.
They used to be able to send it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Can't do that anymore.
Yep. And Ames is unique. We have the resource recovery plant here, which is a system. It's interesting, actually. A lot of municipalities are starting to consider these waste-to-energy systems, they call them now, because of that the action on the Chinese government's part to reduce their importing. I think Lana mentioned that in one of her headlines about the stopgap method, the waste-to-energy plants being a stopgap method. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of communities are looking at that, but I think the fact that it is a stopgap method is something we need to think about. There are issues that are generated when you do burn plastics. You know, there are air pollutants and things like that that you have to look at.
There's some serious ones, like dioxin is the big one that everybody's worried about.
Yeah. So I'm hopeful that because there's sort of a new market or a new glut of raw material on the market, I
guess. Heavy necessity pushing this one.
That maybe, maybe companies or recycling people in the recycling industry will start to produce new technologies here at home that can deal with some of this. But ultimately, I think the first R is the most important in the reduce, reuse, recycle, and that's the reduction of our consumption to begin with, because we can perfect our system for waste disposal here in Ames, but you know, globally, I think reducing what we're consuming is the most impactful, ultimately.
Well, the articles that I read, it said, okay, here's what's happening. Okay, now we can't send it to China. So the current options are landfill.
Mm-hmm.
Not a great idea,
nope.
Obviously. And then incineration, which people are embracing more. But that is not also a perfect solution because it does produce further air pollution. But those are, other than reducing consumption, those two options are, neither of which are really terrific.
Mm-hmm.
So the reducing consumption of plastic, this is where there is some success coming. For example, the European Union as a whole has banned the use of single plastic use bags, plastic straws, and plastic silverware. And even those, you know, they're not even getting into the complexities of other kinds of packaging and, you know, because that gets into there's different kinds of plastics and what do you do with it and da-da-da. But even just removing those basic things, which means it still puts it back to individual responsibility mm-hmm. in some ways. But you can't go to a store and get a plastic bag.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's it. On a related note, interestingly, so last year at the state level, the state enacted some legislation that essentially bans a city from banning plastic bags or prevents a city in Iowa from
making those municipal bans on plastic bags.
Yes. Yep. So as a city, Ames is unable to ban the use of plastic bags.
And this has happened in a few states. Obviously here in Iowa. And so now there is talk about a federal overarching because that's apparently at this point the only way that we're going to get that.
Yeah, the only way you'd get right, at least right, because the federal law would trump Iowa's.
But, yes, it would.
So then it comes down to the retailers and consumers, like you said. I mean, I think at Wheatsfield, for example, we don't have plastic grocery bags available. People can take paper bags or they can bring their own in, and we try to reuse boxes that product comes into for a container. But we don't have plastic bags at the registers. We do still have plastic bags in the produce department and the bulk departments, and that is where, I mean, really you have this balance between what consumers want and what they expect and, you know, and what as a business you're willing to do. So we would definitely encourage people not to use those single-use plastic produce bags, and we would encourage people to bring in their own bulk containers and to use more sustainable containers. But at this point, I think we still feel that we need to have an option for the consumer who mm-hmm, mm-hmm. is not prepared to have their own container and still needs to buy a bulk item or a so we still have them available, but that's one where that's the consumer needs to steer that ship to a certain extent, because as a retailer, we will have available what the consumer demands we have available.
Well, as a retail grocery business in town, when you first implemented the no plastic bag ban at the checkout, how was that received?
Pretty well. I mean, I think our customers were already somewhat trained in bringing in their own bags. And we still have paper bags available. So there's still something. You know, it was mm-hmm. the fact that it wasn't plastic, it was paper instead, didn't seem to upset people too much. Yeah.
Well, I have to give a personal shout out for these little – they're nylon bags that stuff into a little pouch that's, what, maybe 2 inches by 2 inches, and they weigh nothing. And I... and they last a long time. Mm-hmm. You can wash them. You can, and so I have made a habit for many years, actually, of carrying two or three of those in my purse because they weigh so little.
Yeah.
And they're so I always have them. I don't forget them. It's not like they're stuck in the trunk of my car. Mm-hmm. It has made that habit for me very, very doable.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, this day and age, there are a lot of alternatives for single-use stuff. You can get those sort of you get grocery bags that are compact. You can get reusable, bamboo utensils that come in a little pouch. Mm-hmm. You can get a metal straw so mm-hmm. that, you know, that over time we can try to stop using all the disposable mm-hmm. versions of mm-hmm. those items. Yeah. So that's been nice to see the market introduce more of those. But it is as an individual, it is a challenge to always remember your little utensil set, and then you get to a place and you're
right.
like, oh.
It has to be a habit. Or,
we have a long way to go because even walking up and down the aisles, so much stuff is yet prepackaged. Mm-hmm. And what do? You pull off your prepackaged something or other, and there it is in a plastic bag and there's so many different kinds of plastics. Some of them are recyclable and some are not. Mm-hmm. I think of when was it? During the Johnson administration. Yes, I was alive during the Johnson. Back when litter was
right. Don't be a litter bug.
Well, and it took a while. It took a while. People used to chuck beer cans out of windows, and you'd flick paper bags out of windows of in your car. I remember that was just going down
cigarette
the highway.
Butts.
Yeah, that was. Now, it takes a change in how people think, and I think we're just at the beginning of how we are starting to think.
That's a great example, Lana. That was a very successful campaign. People really learned that was, like, publicly not acceptable.
And it's funny. I remember it coming from little kids. I mean, I would seldom ever talk back to my father, but my goodness, I did pipe up when he was stuck throwing his cigarette butts out the window. And I think he was a little taken aback that I would be upset. But it's
right,
a generational
you
change.
At school, right?
Learning those things.
Right.
That's where it comes from. That's where a lot of these changes come from. Oh, goodness. Yes. Actually, I like the fact that, and I'm sure probably other businesses can do this too, all the little boxes that you get in the back room shipping your product in, where all the candy bars come, where all the bags of lettuce come, mm-hmm. then those are moved in your store to the front of the store, and I can fill up that little 10 by 20 box and stack things in there.
Yeah.
It really isn't all that hard.
Yeah, people love that and can take boxes for moving or, you know, whatever they need boxes for. We have an infinite supply. So.
You always need boxes. Now, that may change, too. I mean, thinking 40, 50 years ahead, maybe 10 years ahead, those boxes are made from something, too. And maybe
at least they do biodegrade.
They do. I use them for a lot of different things. But the idea of cutting down trees to mm-hmm. for one use, well, things may change with that. Two, it's amazing how things change.
Well, I'm old enough to remember milk crates,
mm-hmm.
and Pepsi Cola and Coca Cola used to come in glass bottles in little wooden boxes. You know, that had, I don't know, what are they, 6 by 12 or something?
Good question. And do beer bottles that have these little have to recycle tags on them, do they get taken back and filled with beer, or do they get taken back and chopped up?
Taken back and chopped up.
Really? Now, it seems you could wash those out and fill them up again, but that's just me. But there is a, and we'll come back and talk more about the, Iowa's bottle bill,
it's
the up and down of that, and lots of complicated things to talk about. I want to remind you, this is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. This is Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Thank you. Listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Yeah, and we're having a trash show today.
We are. We're talking trash with Bronwyn Beatty Hansen because she knows a lot about what's going on with trash in our local area. It's a global problem, but we have to deal with it locally. We mentioned the bottle bill before, and Donna said, well, who could be against the bottle bill? I mean, isn't that a good idea, speaking of improving our lives? But, Bronwyn, you said that it has to be negotiated every year.
Well, it seems like the state keeps returning to questions about the bottle bill, and
I thought that was a win-win done deal.
It was enacted as a method to ensure the reduction of litter, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. Lana, where if there was a nickel tied to that can or bottle, then for sure people would return it to get that nickel. This day and age, you have sort of a twofold issue with that. For one, a nickel is worthless, so there's periodically talk about maybe upping the deposit on that bottle. But then also you have people who would argue that recycling is just so commonplace anymore and littering is so infrequent that the nickel being tied to the bottle itself doesn't really incentivize – you're going to recycle it anyway is what the thought process is. And it's sort of complicated. As someone who works at a retail shop that deals in redeeming cans and bottles, it can be quite confusing, like what is available for a redemption value. For example, beer, wine, and anything carbonated. So if you have a brand that makes an uncarbonated water in a bottle and they make a carbonated water in a bottle, one has a redemption value and one doesn't.
Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, for goodness sakes.
It gets very – it is a – it can be kind of a complicated system, but yeah, so that's always, I'm always curious what the state might do, in terms of the bottle bill and, no big action on that this year, but it's always something I watch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We'll talk more about what, some of the, as a member of the city council, what the city's methods of looking, this is a big issue.
Big part of our government here.
Pick a topic.
Good question. Yeah, so trash disposal is often, that's a municipal responsibility. And here in Ames, we don't pick it up ourselves. We know we have third parties that do that, say Chitty or Waste Management or Aaron's or some of the others. But they all do, they all then bring that garbage that they pick up to the city's resource recovery plant. And it's interesting. So, over the time that the resource recovery plant has been in operation, it's kind of interesting to see the numbers fluctuate of the amount of material we're able to process.
Oh, able to process.
So, just for example, this last year in 2018, of the garbage that was picked up by haulers, about 70% of it made its way to the resource recovery plant for sorting. The other 30% went straight to landfill.
Oh.
Without sorting. And that was because the resource recovery plant sells the RDF, the resource-derived fuel. They sell it to the power plant, which is right next door. So the resource recovery plant and the power plant are next door to one another. And if there's a...
Right here in the downtown.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
And if there's a breakdown in that system, then garbage can't be rotated through that system in a timely manner.
What would make a breakdown? Like an equipment problem?
Exactly.
Or we just get too much garbage?
in the case of 2018, it was an equipment issue. And this came from the conversion of the power plant from coal to natural gas.
Now, when did we do that?
Oh, 2015.
And that was that's baby steps, but it's a very good thing.
Yes. I mean, natural gas is cleaner
than coal.
Yep. Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so it was a good step forward. But what that did was it creates more moisture in the area where the RDF gets incinerated. And the moisture combined with the chemicals that are put out by the RDF when it's being burned created an acid issue on the tubes in the boilers. And so actually on this council agenda tonight, we have an item to approve a $6 million improvement to the power plant where we're going to get all the tubes in those boilers coated with a special coating.
Okay, so because we changed from coal to gas, mm-hmm. we now have to do a $6 million upgrade to the system itself.
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Yeah,
okay.
Because the acids were eating away the tubes faster than they used to when we burned coal. Mm-hmm. So we have to improve that system. But once those Inconel tubes are in place, hopefully we would see then a return to the level of processing we used to have. Mm-hmm. But that was just
one. You mean in terms of volume?
Yeah, because if you think about it, I mean, it's kind of interesting. But in 2018, the total garbage generated here in the city was 52,000 tons. Mm. And of that, about 16,000 tons went to landfill because we weren't able to process
it
all. And we always have, some amount going to landfill, but it was higher than usual in 2018 because of that boiler tube issue.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a complicated system. You know, it's interesting and it's it is complicated to think about how we could do things better. And I have a few suggestions that I might mention for
Please do.
for how but mostly, how residents can do things better and then other things the city is looking at or might look at to improve our systems. One is on the individual end or the resident end, we should be trying to get undesirable material out of the garbage. So
Tell us what's undesirable.
Yeah, the main two. The first one would be glass. It doesn't ever incinerate, just gums up the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So people should not be throwing glass in their garbage.
Okay, let me ask you. I always have this dilemma. Okay, if I've got a glass jelly jar that's empty, I wash it and I put it in the recycler. However, if I break a light bulb or a plate, what do I do with those glass shards?
Good question. So the resource recovery plant has a little household hazardous waste drop-off area at the resource recovery plant, and they will take things like batteries and light bulbs and waste oil, the things that are those sort of...
Okay, so a broken cup should not be put into the recycling.
Well, ceramic isn't really recyclable in that manner.
Glass.
Ah, I see. I think that...
My water glasses.
Yep,
they break.
Into the recycling would be okay. I mean, there's... Broken glass gets into recycling
mm-hmm.
through the process anyway. But there are some... If people don't have recycling service at their house that they're sending stuff away with, there are bins in town where you can drop off glass and should drop off glass rather than put it in the garbage. So that's the first one that we could easily...
Is recycle the glass.
Yep.
Okay.
Recycle the glass. Second is food waste, compost, biological
stuff. Oh, this is true. Mary Rankin told me that a few years ago they ran an analysis of the percentage of incinerated material that was actually being burned for fuel, and it was way lower than they hoped for or was possible because it was too wet.
Yes. And not only because of the wet stuff itself, but because the wet stuff gets everything else wet, too,
mm-hmm.
and then it doesn't burn as well.
Like, don't put your coffee grounds on top of the
paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think we actually have since that study, the city has looked at a few things to try to improve our waste systems, especially in regards to compost.
Mm-hmm.
So our first step that's in action now is a rebate program for individuals to get a composting barrel or a composting system at their home and do some composting privately, so as an individual. So those rebates are available. People can check out the city's website to find out more information about the composting rebate program, or it was recently in the little flyer we get in our energy bill, too. There was
mm-hmm.
a blurb about it in there. So, again, that would be a way to start just as an individual. But then I think over time the city will consider what we can do about compostable material.
Well, there are Carolyn Raffensperger and I were talking about this over, this is our to start a little chit-chat conversations. And she's very well informed about environmental issues. And she was saying that Minneapolis, for example, has a citywide composting program. So there are places where they actually pick it up at your house. They put it all in one big thing. They make soil out of it, and then they distribute that soil to, like, local parks. And, you know, it is something good can come of it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that would be something we might consider. You'd have to buy a fleet of trucks for it.
Yeah, it's a much bigger deal.
Thing.
Yeah.
They probably have, if they're doing waste pickup already, they probably have trucks. And since Ames doesn't haul our own garbage, we'd have to get a whole fleet for something like that. But we might, you know, those are the sort of things we're thinking about long term. Like maybe we could have some sort of facility out in the county where people could drop off stuff, or perhaps there's a third party company that eventually can get to the scale where they can do residential curbside
pickup.
That's
true. I mean, I would be happy to pay a few more dollars on my chitty garbage bill to have
compost, yeah.
Compost taken away.
Yeah. The idea of encouraging individuals to do it on an individual basis, it kind of has another positive sort of thing. If you're actually doing it yourself, you see what is...
Yeah, you got to think about it.
You have to think about it. This may not be for everyone, but you can feed all that good stuff to chickens, usually, a lot of it. Or there are... chickens are a little bit too rowdy for you, there are people that use worms for compost.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good bit of livestock, too. And that can be a kids' school project. It can be a family project. It's a whole different way of looking at how we live. I like the idea of compost.
I do some silly little personal things. For example, you know, my cup of coffee every day, I produce coffee grounds. Well, I know that coffee grounds are good for the garden. So I just go out on my back porch and I randomly throw the coffee grounds out. Mm-hmm. There are also, I do have a possum that visits every night and he has a little route. And I know there are things that the possum likes to eat. And he's cute. And also... possums eat ticks. Hello. This is a good thing, right? So there are things that I know that the possum likes. So I have a little place in the bushes where I throw, like I was doing cleaning squash out last night. So the possum likes the squash seeds. And actually, so do the squirrels.
Does he prefer a certain kind of squash?
No, but, you know, those big seeds are kind of juicy. And the other local wildlife really. But there's not everything that you can throw, like, you know. If I threw too many banana peels and orange peels out, it would become rather unsightly.
Well, also, you'd start calling in all the local monkeys. You don't want to do that. They can be kind of dead.
But thinking, you got monkeys out there,
yeah,
Lana.
But thinking about where things go and our heads up from the country of China, all of a sudden they decide, well, wait a minute. We don't want your stuff. Deal with your own stuff. It's a good way of thinking about how we as people are existing on this planet. Very good. Very good.
Well, and when you look at the whole of the European Union, which is not a small deal, it's multiple countries. It's not just multiple cities. It's multiple countries have all agreed that no more plastic bags, no more plastic forks, no more plastic straws. And then there's the state of Iowa, which has passed a law saying, no, you can't have a law like that. There is talk now at the federal government, because Iowa's not the only state that's done that, that we do need a federal law for this, because then that would clarify all of this.
And I think to a certain extent, people have to accept the fact that we can't live so much in a world of convenience anymore. I think part of...
personal limitation, Bronwyn.
Right? Part of what happened in China was they were getting a stream of really disgusting gross recyclables, and they have to spend a lot of money and effort to clean them. And I think people can't expect to throw all their waste in one bin and have someone else deal with it for them. Like, we have
even
to take...
Even here locally... I rinse out my mayonnaise jar very well before I put it. In fact, sometimes the peanut butter jars, they're the worst. Sometimes I run them through the dishwasher to get them clean enough to put into the recycling. I don't know. Is that a maniacal thing?
No, I mean, I think I just think that eventually a perfect system is going to be a little more complicated than throwing everything in one bin. That might be perfect for the consumer, but it's not a sustainable system in its entirety. So the consumer is going to have to be doing some sorting of product and reducing their use of products on their own.
When we started with recycling, we did that.
Yeah.
There was the box for the cans and the glass, and then the box for the newspaper, and then the the compost box.
Yeah. We can learn to think, and maybe this is a good thing, to think less about me, myself, and I, and think a little bit more about we. Think a little bit more about the community and the world in general. And that's not a bad way to live. You're listening to KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. Find out more at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. So these thoughts that we've been exploring about trash, about garbage, there's burnable things that we do here in Ames. There's recycling things that we try to do all over. There's composting things that we're trying to do. Bronwyn, say a little bit more about Ames as a community that uses burnables, trash, for energy?
Yes, that is a great question. And I think what I wish the people of Ames understood about the resource recovery plan, maybe some folks do, but what I wish were more clear is that it's not a system that brings us a great deal of cheap energy. It's designed as...
to get rid of a problem.
It's designed, as a way to avoid landfilling. And so it's not that the energy we get from the RDF saves us a huge amount of money or anything like that. It's that we're not landfilling it. And so if people are hoping that the energy generation...
I'll just throw this trash away and now it's going to make more electricity.
Yeah, right?
It's not quite that straightforward.
Not quite that simple, yep. So, and as you look long term... You know, if Ames ever were to hope to go 100% solar, 100% wind and solar together, we would have to find another way then to deal with our landfill diversion. The resource recovery plant is tied to the electric
plant. Oh, the gas
plant.
Burn, yeah.
Yeah, so the two are tied together. Having the resource recovery plant as our method of landfill diversion sort of
keeps us tied to the coal
us
and
to
oil industry,
fossil
right?
fuels, mm-hmm. yeah. So I think people should just think about that long term and what that means. It might be an okay system for now, especially as the recyclables market is recovering from this big setback, I would say. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it's just interesting to think about. And again, to think about the fact that not all of your trash is being processed through the resource recovery plant. We process as much as we can, but I don't want folks to think, oh, I can just throw it away and I'm doing good. I mean, we should be more conscientious about our consumption than that.
I have a question. So when my garbage, my private garbage company, of which we all use one or another in town, when it takes the garbage to the city's incinerator, do they have to pay the city?
Yeah.
To, Okay, so the city is deriving some income stream from the fee that I pay to have my garbage pulled away.
Yeah, you would call that a tipping fee. Yeah, okay. there are tipping okay. fees. Yep, and that those rates are arranged with the haulers and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, is the short answer to that.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean, I think yeah, just ultimately, again, it's not such a simple system to say, oh, it's generating all this great electricity. It generates some electricity. It does offset some natural gas use, but...
Well, and there is that huge question about burning plastics, period, in any circumstance, does produce dioxin, which is highly toxic. It's a major air pollutant, and we don't know how much we're burning here in Ames. I mean, yeah, there are scrubbers. Some of it can be, you know, we've probably never tested in Ames even how much dioxin we emit.
Yeah, I have not seen a figure on that, at least on my time on council.
No, yeah. And every time I ask people, you know, like in positions to know better, they just go, oh, no, well, the engineer said it doesn't, so are we testing? No.
So maybe this is a heads up because everybody was sending the materials to China because their contamination standard was low. And then all of a sudden, China decided to look at what they were doing. And they said, whoa, that's not so good.
Well,
so maybe
yeah.
it's not
part
so good
of it,
for
I
us
think
either.
Is China is at this point producing enough of its own plastic that they don't even need ours.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a global issue for sure. Mm-hmm. For sure.
And I just want to go back to one of my other headlines here. The humans are pooping plastic, and no one's certain how bad that is. It's from an article from the Huffington Post that I picked up. All of these plastics, there's no away, folks. All of these plastics are breaking down into small itty-itty bits. And the studies they are doing, everyone has little bits of plastic in us.
And it's entering the food system in
so many ways.
For example, there was an article, I don't even remember where it was, but you know, when you're using your yoga clothes, your polyester stretchy yoga clothes, and every time you wash those in your washing machine, they shed micro bits of plastic, which are then going into the water systems, the municipal water systems, and then they get carried to the ocean. And now, you know, we're finding, you know, not the whale that washed up on shore that had 4 tons of plastic bags in them. Yes, that's an obvious thing, but almost all of the fish and marine life now have microscopic, like, plastic bits. And it's not just from the micro beads in the face scrub, but it's from our, you know, polyester gym shorts. And so there's, the solution for that apparently is there's a little thing that you can buy, like some kind of ball thing that you throw into your washing machine that holds those things so they don't go into the water stream. Or you can also put a filter on your washing machine that catches it in the exit water. I mean, it's so complicated.
It is. And then, question done. What do you do with the little ball when it's full? That's another waste thing. Here we go.
If you empty the little ball or the filter and you do put it into your plastic recycling, that does keep it out of the water system.
Oh, my goodness.
It goes somewhere else, but it, at least it's not in the drinking water or in the agriculture, you know. Complicated.
Oh, Bronwyn, I think we have opened up a can of worms. Maybe a can of worms that will help
with worms?
Composting worms.
I'm going to be looking into more of this composting with worms. I mean, I have lots of compost bins on my farm, but the idea that there's these little guys that are specialists.
Let me ask you, Bronwyn, if the city is going to encourage a compost rebate, could they not also make a little small education about this worm composting business, which is backyard manageable, not expensive, and kind of a fun science experiment for a family?
Good question. So there is I actually just went with my daughter to Meeker, had a science night, or they had a
– with worms?
And so they had the folks there from the resource recovery plant showing some composting options, and they did in fact have a bin of composting worms and were providing info to kids about that. So I assume it's also available on the website. But no, you're right. I mean, I think it's the more methods people have at their disposal,
the better. Hey, we did rain barrels. Let's use composting worms now.
Yeah. Well, and composting, you know, it's good for soil health, too. So it helps water quality as well, which is interesting.
Just those win-win-win sort of
exactly.
things.
Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Very good. Thank you for being with us today, Bronwyn.
Oh, thank you.
This is good. We haven't figured out everything yet, but we'll work on it.
Thank you for your time on the city council. You know, we really need to thank people who do this to run our city.
Well, thank you. I appreciate
that. It's time-consuming, and I'm sure sometimes a little irritating.
Oh, no. Well, because you're dealing with
people. It's complicated.
Okay. Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Democracy is a sloppy business, right?
Yeah. So remember, when you go into a store, take along your recyclable bag. It isn't that hard. Consider it another purse. You can do that. That's good. Well, good. We've been talking about trash today. We've been talking about trash and burning things and recycling things and composting things. And we all affect where we live. We all affect our environment. And as Iowa wakes up, there's a lot of positive things happening. All this compost can be put to good use. Seedlings can be started and compost can be made. This is the time of year also to think of all the upcoming good food and good stuff that is going to be growing.
Yeah, I look out my back door and my whole backyard looks like a compost.
Well, but spring will come. And farmers are out there kind of planning the season, so think of looking into community-supported agriculture this year. Find yourself a farmer, and you don't have to have a plastic bag to go to a farmer's market. You can just go and take a basket. Be ever so pastoral and shop with a basket. You can do that at the farmer's market. That will be probably starting up all over Iowa in the first part of May.
Right, probably another month. We're back to farmer's market.
Oh, okay. Start thinking of that asparagus, strawberries. Oh, yeah. Things are good. There's some upcoming events here at the at KHOI, at this very radio station, which is in the old Pantorium building on Douglas Avenue, downtown Ames. There's a Pantorium session tomorrow evening, Wednesday evening. Iowa, no mountain boys. Some good old bluegrass music. But Iowa has no mountains, so it's the Iowa, no mountain boys. And actually, I heard it's not all boys. It's some women, too. So anyway, traditional bluegrass. And you can hear it right here. That's 7 o'clock Wednesday evening, 410 Douglas Avenue, part of the Pantorium Center. There's lots of good things happening here.
There's also Thursday night somewhere on campus. I think it's in the Memorial Union. A man named David Montgomery is lecturing. It's the John Pesek lecture where he's talking about soil.
Very good.
So if you really want to pursue composting, you might want to catch David Montgomery Thursday night at 7 in the Memorial Union.
Another good upcoming thing. Good. Oh, and here is a quick, sad goodbye to Hanson Sinclair, a gas station here in town that is going out of business.
You're kidding.
Yeah. And so anyway, thanks for all your
good
work.
They're one of the few people left that washes your windshield and puts air in your tires.
See?
Oh, no. And taco time, too.
Yeah.
They're gone as well.
Yeah.
See?
Oh, no.
Things move on. Oh, my goodness. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Thanks to our guests today, Bronwyn Beattie Hansen, talking about trash. Listen to the Donna Lana Kitchen Tuesdays at noon or 7 p.m. or any time. We had music today by the band Nightingale. Nightingale, they're a fine bunch of folk from Canada, someplace or other, up there. Yes, support this fine station. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintos.
We've had fine engineering by Trey Moore today. And we thank you, our listener, for joining us. Eat good food and enjoy life.